The Guardian.
Hello, Ian Sample here. And before we get started with today's edition of Science Weekly, I'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For more about building beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. And now, on with the show.
Her vocal folds are working moderately hard. It's not particularly loud, it's not particularly strong. The defining factor of that sound is the shape of the resonating space, which is huge. The tongue is low and back, the roof of the mouth is raised, the soft palate is closed very hard.
How does the human voice work? What makes our speaking voices so distinctive and so recognisable? And how can we transform the way we use our voices? Coinciding with a new exhibition at the Wellcome Collection, This Is a Voice is a book by Jeremy Fisher and Gillian Kayes, offering 99 exercises to train, project and harness the power of your voice. Jeremy and Gillian join me in the studio, along with Steve Connor, Professor of English at the University of Cambridge, who's written extensively on the history of the voice, sound and music. Gillian, let's start with, how does our voice actually work? What's going on inside our bodies to make these sounds?
We need something to oscillate to make sound, and that in the voice is either the vocal folds or the lips, or sometimes air and the tongue. So if we're doing buzzing sounds, we might be shh, like that. Then there's no vocal fold vibration, but there's vibration inside the mouth space. Mm-hmm. We need airflow to make that happen. That's the big thing. So we need airflow, we need something oscillating, and that is the sound source.
So I hear that there are two different kinds of vocal cords, though. What's that all about?
That's absolutely right. Properly speaking, the false vocal folds are not folds. They're not even made of muscle, so they're completely different construction. They're actually where your mucus glands sit. So they're quite important. Now, we need mucus. We swallow a lot of mucus every day. There are two sets of folds, and it's all to do with the sort of the primary functioning of the larynx, because the larynx originally wasn't there for speaking and singing. It was there to protect the airways. It is still there to protect the airways. So when we swallow, the true vocal folds close, the false vocal folds close, the epiglottis folds down. This is sort of working backwards, actually. The soft palate also closes. Imagine sneezing while eating soup. You don't want to go
messy.
There.
Messy. Very messy, I would imagine. So let's talk about different sounds that we make. So we've got normal speech, and then we've got laughter and crying and shouting. These are all different sounds, different mechanisms that go into making them.
The mechanism for laughter in terms of what the vocal folds are doing is really the same as for vowels in speech. We nearly always laugh on vowels, although, of course, we do snigger. We do go... But it's very different from the control that we have when we use speech, because when you watch someone laughing, you actually see these quite big movements of the chest wall. And that means that you can't really make the controlled sounds that you need to regulate, you know, linguistic stress and some of the consonants that we need for speech. It's also a different part of the brain. It's an emotional centre rather than that cognitive centre.
I think we've got a clip of, I think it's Kathy Jensen, with a very distinctive laugh going on here. Jeremy, that's a very distinctive sound. I mean, do people have characteristic laughs then?
Very much, and I think they have characteristic coughs and characteristic sneezes as well. What's interesting about that particular laugh, and it is quite extended, she makes so many different laughing sounds, she makes so many different laughing pitches, there are different tempos, there are different speeds. And so it's a really complex laugh. Also, almost every sound she makes is voiced. So there's one... And everything else uses the true vocal folds, so there is voicing there all the time.
What does our laughter tell us about us then? Is it something that we develop our own special laughs?
Laughter's almost like a language that doesn't have words. So you're revealing something about yourself, And you can use, you can laugh on different vowels, which is fascinating. So you can do and they reveal different things about you.
And did you notice, Nicola, that when we played that clip, we were all joining in? It's a very social thing, isn't it?
Steve, do you want to add something about here,
yes,
about laughter?
Well, there's one thing that I will pass on, which is passed on to me by a theatre director, which is that if you want to make a laugh sound convincing, make sure you're nearly out of breath. If you fill your lungs with air, which sounds like a good idea if you're going to do some energetic laughing, it doesn't sound like it's coming from the right place, because it's got to be a kind of staged dramatization of being out of control, which is partly out of control. So it's a part, that is what I think is involved in a thing like the laugh and the cough. These are not things that we are consciously producing in the way in which I'm forming this sentence in process you're listening to, but we do nevertheless produce them and do a kind of work on them. There is, as we call it in the trade, a prosody. There's a particular kind of structure. As a matter of fact, a laugh is among the most highly structured kinds of utterance that we produce. That's why you have your own repertoire of laughs, and it's really you, and there actually isn't much you can do about it.
Let's talk about some other kinds of sounds that you make. So what about screaming and shouting? What's going on there? Is that a different process in one's body that one's using to produce these sounds?
Well, what we do when we shout, essentially, is we raise our voice, and normally there's something really important we have to say. So obviously we've increased loudness. You might have noticed as well that I actually held on to some vowels longer than I normally would in speech. And obviously that's something I've taught myself to do because I work with actors as well as singers. But in fact, I think there's an emotional thing, which is you're not listening to what it is that I want to say, and therefore we elongate that vowel. Also, we know that pitch and volume co-vary. So if I raise my pitch, it's heard as louder. That's why a baby screaming. We had wonderful evidence of that this morning, didn't we? In the underground carriage. Small baby making noises, pre-verbal. And you could see people going, oh, because it's a very high pitch.
Our voices contain far more information than maybe just the words that we're forming. So you've got tone, and you've got the volume, you've got the pitch, and all the different things we're talking about there. What can we learn about someone from their voice? Not just from what they're saying, but from the way in which they're saying it.
I just want to talk a little bit about the mechanism for tone of voice, because I got as far as vocal fold vibration and breath when you asked me about vocal production. But I didn't go further up into the tube of the vocal tract, you know, which is it's an airspace, really. We have a personal acoustic space in there, and we can change the shape of that space. There are lots of interconnecting resonating chambers in there that you're probably not conscious of, but that's what we do. So, for example, I could lower my larynx a little bit and sound kind of a little bit more plummy like that, and that might place me as an actress or someone like that. On the other hand, I could tighten my lips and sort of raise my tongue like this, and I could sound maybe a little bit like Hamad or somebody from that kind of class and that era. It's all a little bit clipped as well. I don't know if you notice that. The way I'm producing the consonants is different as well.
Jeremy, I mean, what does this tell us about people, the way that they speak and the way that their speech maybe changes?
There are habitual things that you do. There are certain things that you can change with your voice, and there are certain things that you can't. You can't change the size and texture of your vocal folds. Once you've gone past puberty, that's really the size and shape of your voice that you've got. You can hear that I've got quite a low voice, and that means that my vocal folds are quite long and thick, and that makes me a bass. But one of the things that I can do is to change the shapes above the vocal folds, so I can change the type of language that I use, the shape of the language that I use. So as Gillian just demonstrated, you can make your voice brighter or darker, but you can also change your pronunciation style. And a lot of people don't want to sound like they come from a particular place. Interestingly, I'm a Shropshire lad originally, and even from the age of about 4, I didn't sound like anyone else in Shropshire. Shropshire is really quite a country accent, and I always sounded like BBC Radio 4.
Is that a conscious thing, just like changing your accent by changing the way that you pronounce words?
I think it is, yes. I think that you can do certain things very consciously. Interestingly, in the UK, that places you very particularly into a group of people. And you can decide to change that. There are dialect coaches around who will do that and help you do that. Also, dialect is very important for actors because they need to change character, depending on the role that they're playing. So they need to be able to change what they're doing and to change the way that they talk to match the character.
So, Steve, what would you say about this idea of changing the way that we speak?
It's very important in, I mean, the evolution of language and certainly in its function, that we are fantastically good at producing complicated sounds and we're really, really good mimics, like a lot of primates, but we're fantastically good mimics when it comes to speech. And that means that we can borrow sounds and accents and we can partially become other people. We can quote not only words, but vocal idioms. What's more, we can't help but do it because what we think of as our own voices are always a sort of repertoire of different possibilities. And this comes from this rather extraordinary thing that when contrasted with the face, we can hear ourselves speak and we're always hearing ourselves speak. And as a matter of fact, you can even think of a voice as itself a kind of listening device because, you know, your voice will pick up accents without you meaning to at all. As you go through life, you might actually find there are interesting reversions. I find myself sounding like my mother, who is not still with us and hasn't been for quite a while, later in life. Just as, you know, you look at photographs of yourself later in life, you think, good heavens, I'm starting to look like my father or Uncle Jim. So in a way, you're in the middle of your voice as well as behind your voice producing it. And that capacity to inhabit a whole range of inflective possibilities is what having a voice means. And we know this because when it goes wrong and somebody doesn't have melody or variation in their voice or has the wrong kind of melody, I mean, teaching foreign speakers to speak English is much, much more than teaching them the words and the grammatical structures. It's teaching them a particular kind of curve. Latinate languages have a reputation for being very musical. But if you listen to a Spanish person speaking English who hasn't got a very good English accent, it is the flattest and for many English ears, the ugliest kind of sound that you can imagine. Spanish people have to work very, very hard to acquire a sort of English tonality. Dutch people, Northern European people don't have to work so hard. Their sentences have the same sort of shape as ours.
Gillian, one of the things I wanted to ask you there was about vocal fry. So this is one of the phenomena that has sort of taken off, which is particularly in young women, this way of speaking. Perhaps can you describe what it is better than I can here and also why that's come about?
Well, I think it's quite likely it's come over from America. You know, we are very influenced by American culture. It also, I don't know if you know, but historically, it used to be part of an upper-class accent to just have a little kind of like that as well. It's sort of it's almost like I'm not really revealing what I feel, and it's all kind of part of that clipping. One of the things that will allow you to drop into vocal fry is actually having very low airflow. So if things are kind of quite held in that system, what happens is then you just drop down like that. I'd actually like Jeremy, though, to explain what the vocal folds are doing in fry.
Okay, voice science moment. In standard speech, what happens is that the vocal folds clap together. They're held very, very slightly apart, and the airflow passes through them, and the Bernoulli principle causes them to close and open pretty fast. Soprano high C is 1,047 times a second, which is pretty incredible. And therefore, they close, and they're pushed open again by the air, and they close and pushed open. What happens in creak is the airflow is so low and the vocal folds are so relaxed that they do a sort of double clap. So you do a full clap and then a little half clap as well, and essentially it slows it down by a full octave. So if I demonstrate... Now, if I was to stay in that, it's going to sound like creak, okay?
And that sort of creaking sound is what we mean by this vocal fry.
Absolutely. Creak and vocal fry are essentially the same thing. We were told off by the speech therapists, though, because they say one is the unhealthy version, which is the squeezed version, which is this. And the other is the healthy version.
Here we're talking about a trend, a fashion, really, that's come over. How does our voice reflect our cultural identity?
Well, it's very important that, you know, there are lots and lots of stages and dimensions to everything involved with a voice. So there is how we make our voices, but then there is what we make of how we make our voices. Now, it seems to me that fry or the creaky voice is very different when we're talking about kind of upper class creaky voice, or if we're talking about California you know, and you just need to say California and you almost kind of go into the voice. I think they're very, very different associations. I think it has something to do with the low airflow. I think it has something to do with adolescent girls laughing together. This is to be expected. This is what happens because these things are, they're selected and adapted for different purposes, and those purposes are not apparent when they come into being. They come into being by a sort of a chance and they get amplified very unpredictably by different things. And then people do them because other people do them. You know, like so much in evolutionary history, it's a mixture between chance and fit. So we're always making things of what we're hearing. And very often we're doing that by means of a sort of cultural symbolism. Not all of it is cultural. I mean, you know, a lot of the same features are apparent in angry voices that we've already heard Gillian talking about. But in a way, what you're doing with an angry voice is demonstrating with the imaginary stuff or plasma of your voice what you propose to do to your interlocutor, right? So you chop up the easy melodic flow of a sentence in much the same way that it's being suggested by the voice. You might chop the person up, you know.
There's
a kind of violence. But there's an awful lot. I mean, sometimes we seem to enact a kind of caress of our own voices. We seem to enact, play out relations. And these relations are very largely physical. They have to do with things like gesture and with posture and with this, not so much with sound as an abstract thing, but it's as though we are imagining the sound, as I say, as some physical stuff that we're manipulating. And most of us are not able to do this thing called speaking without actually employing our hands to double up the particular action that we think we might be doing. We might be making very, very tiny distinctions, and then my fingers are now forming little pincers to try to demonstrate what my voice is also trying to act out. Interestingly, when you try to imitate other people, it's much easier if you don't try to think about imitating their voices, if you try to think about making your face look like their face. That's not how we learn our own language, but that's a very effective way, as the work of Sophie Scott at UCL has shown. It's a very effective way for an impressionist to get someone's voice. It's just to get one little thing about the look of their face, and somehow that pulls the whole of the rest of the body in.
I want to talk about impact because there's a very interesting film at the This Is a Voice Welcome exhibition on gender and people crossing gender and what they have to do with their voice. And I'm thinking about the Creek in particular. When you think about Creek, and Steve brought up Valley Girls, the California Girls thing, it's almost immediately where you go to when you think of creaking. You go to girls particularly. And one of the things that I could see about using a creak is that you are having an opinion, but you're not presenting it strongly. You're sort of backing off slightly. One of the interesting things in the film at the exhibition talks about the impact that you have to create when you're doing female to male change, and particularly on the telephone, because there are no visual cues at all. And the man in the film talks about the day when he was talking on the phone and the person on the other end said, "Thank you, sir." So that his voice had the impact, the prosody, the language, if you like, of the male voice rather than the female voice.
Perhaps there's one other thing here which we should talk about, which is head voice. So this is what's going on. This is how we think. We think in sentences as well, often. So what's going on there? Because our head voice sounds like us too.
Well, this is also fascinating. We were talking just before we started about hearing voices in your head, and this is another part of the exhibition, which is absolutely fascinating. There's a film by Chris Chapman on the use of computer avatars to recreate the voice that's in your head. And so they use a computer program to play a voice to the person who has voices in their head and wants to get rid of them. The subject matches up the voice that they hear with the voice that's coming out of the computer. And then the therapist goes into a different room and uses that computer-generated voice as a conversational tool. And so the person with the voice in their head can actually get that voice outside and have a conversation with it and deal with the emotional and the psychological effects of it. It is an extraordinary film. So useful.
It was a female who was having the therapy, but the voice in her head was male.
Very wow. Deep male.
Steve, the art of oratory, of public speaking, is about the words that you say, but also about how you say them. Can you give us some examples of public figures that use their voices well and people that maybe don't do it so well?
Well, we've got some good contemporary examples. President Obama, I think it's all become rather familiar. We've got rather used to his particular little tricks. To begin with, he was sounded very courageous about the amount of time that he would pause for. And it's a tremendously commanding and controlling thing to do, because it's showing we're vulnerable all the time to people interrupting us. Not actually when we're giving speeches, but when you pause in a speech, it's almost like you're saying, come on in if you think you're hard enough, you know. But you can't, can you? Because I don't even have to speak to hold your attention. So that's a very commanding device. I mean, these are all things that you have to learn, you have to be schooled in, but then that's what human beings do. We learn all kinds of complicated things. I think that anybody who speaks in a way that allows their speech to appear to run away with them, people who get very excited and can't finish sentences, and then it's very, very hard to feel that you trust that kind of person. But when something called the elocution movement began in the late 18th century, it was almost entirely an art of gesture. It was felt that what really mattered was what you did with your hands. And actually, when I look at young people doing lecturing practice, nearly always the most important thing is not how they're speaking, but how they're standing. Most people, you know, they might be able to sound quite convincing, but their legs are all sort of twisted up. So their legs are saying, I really feel very knotted up, despite the fact that my sentences, I'm reading these sentences out and they're coherent, but I'm really knotted up. Standing still is an incredibly hard thing for people to do. But when you do it, it's extraordinary the person you become. And the person, as it were, your voice becomes. By the way, the word person means persona. It means through sound. So your person is the thing that comes through the sound of your voice. And you can build it.
Just thinking about pace, pitch and power. So pace particularly is important. And I know Steve's already mentioned this. The use of the pause. What's interesting is when somebody puts a pause in and doesn't do it in the place that you would expect it to. So what then happens is that your listener becomes slightly uncomfortable and doesn't know when to join in. So pauses are really useful. And you can either do a pause or you can deliberately not do a pause if you don't want people to join in. Pitch is fascinating. It depends whether you're on microphone. It depends whether you are speaking live without a microphone. Because we talk about raising our voice in order to be heard, you are literally raising your pitch because it's easier to hear. On a microphone, you don't need to do that. And it also depends how big you want to appear. There's a very interesting, I know Gillianne has looked at this, there's a very interesting thing about pitch with Hillary Clinton.
Yes, we were actually doing an informal analysis the other day of Hillary Clinton compared with Angela Merkel. Because there's a lot of stuff in the news at the moment about Hillary Clinton's voice and she's been criticised. And so we thought, OK, let's have a listen. Let's try and work out where we are. Hillary Clinton is speaking about an octave higher than she was 15 years ago. So when she gave the rather famous speech about women's rights back in 1995, she was speaking on the F below middle C, or it might even have been the A flat, but certainly below middle C, which is what we would expect in an adult woman. And now when she's at the convention, the sort of the triumphal, the victory speech, she's speaking much higher and she's perceived as being shrill and shouting. And moreover, sort of underneath, you can hear that her voice is a little bit husky. So we've got this sort of big effort to make this kind of loud, slightly harsh sound. She also has what we would describe as a very twangy voice. In the book, we called it the edgy bright setting. And you can hear that when you use a little bit of that. And it's very typical of certain American accents. Then that also gives volume. So you kind of got a double whammy there. Now, Angela Merkel doesn't do that. Angela Merkel is speaking about the A below middle C, and she has a range of about six notes. So you hear that cadence. What you didn't get with Hillary Clinton was that she was absolutely up on that pitch nearly all the time.
And why has her voice changed so much? Do we know why that might be?
I happen to know, because it's in the news, that she has a hypothyroid condition, mm-hmm. and that tends to make your voice slightly husky. Now, whether she's trying to sound younger, I don't know. you know, that might be the reason for the underlying huskiness.
Let's talk a bit about singing, because that's another big reason why we use our voices. And I think we have a couple of clips here of different singers singing the same song, actually. So the first one there was the opera singer Jessie Norman, mm-hmm. and the second was, of course, Leanne Rimes.
Jessie Norman, obviously operatic voice, but let's just analyse what it is that she's doing. Her vocal folds are working moderately hard. It's not particularly loud, it's not particularly strong. The defining factor of that sound is the shape of the resonating space, which is huge. The tongue is low and back, the roof of the mouth is raised, the soft palate is closed very hard. So if I was to do it in my speaking voice, she's essentially in this position. Leanne Rimes is much more conversational. She's actually much closer to her speaking voice, her own speaking voice. Mm-hmm. So it's got quite a lot of cutting edge to it. I'm sorry, I can't do the accent. Accent is not my thing. She's also doing a much smaller resonating space. The tongue is much higher. So again, a lot of the change is in resonation. The vocal folds, in her case, are working slightly harder. They're slightly thicker. They've got a little more muscle mass in.
She also uses a little bit of that cooing voice that Steve demonstrated for us so nicely earlier on, that kind of, amazing, and then kind of contrasting that with the slightly edgy sound that Jeremy's just described. And those nuances are actually very expressive. So in non-classical music, that sort of ability to, you have the permission really to change your voice quality mid-note, whereas in classical music, it tends to be very stable.
Steve. One of the things that I think has really inflected this very powerfully is amplification, that we live in a world in which our voices are produced by means of and almost, you know, compounded with other kinds of devices, most particularly the microphone, which, of course, in the 1940s made possible an entirely new way of singing, a way of commanding a very large space without being loud. Crooning. People found it irresistible. It was incredibly sexy. So I think an awful lot of what is going on in the singing voice for us now is about the sense of proximity and that strangeness of somebody who can seem to be a very long way away and yet be heard as though they were actually, you know, at your ear. And that often involves quite a lot of the sort of noise of the voice, the kinds of things that people recording us like this don't really like, all the sort of, you know, slurps and hisses and all that and pops of the voice. But that's very, very powerful. When the telephone was first invented and deployed in 1876, there was a female journalist called Kate Field, who was absolutely fascinated by the erotic possibilities of the telephone voice because it was such a moist voice. She said, who knew that you could kiss by telephone?
So here is a clip of Shlomo, and you can hear a lot of examples of the kind of sounds that Steve has just been talking about. So that's a pretty exciting example of beatboxing going on there. What's actually happening when people are doing that?
There's lots and lots of techniques going on, quite a lot of which, Steve is correct, they're coming from the hisses and slurps of spoken voice, but there's a lot of pressure behind them, much more pressure than you would normally do in spoken voice. For instance, he's doing a P, 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 but now I'm going to step back a little because it's much more pressurised. Also, what's fascinating about that is normally in spoken voice, you have air behind it. So you have pulmonic air coming up from the lungs to do p, p, and you can hear the air blast after it. With this particular one, the vocal folds are closed. There is no air coming up from the lungs at all. And you are using just the air inside your mouth, and you're using your tongue to push the air forwards through your lips. So it's non-pulmonic pressurized external air. And there's lots and lots of noises that are made like that in beatboxing. We actually, in the book, I think I do something like 17 beatboxing exercises.
And that was just scratching the surface.
Absolutely.
When you're looking at beatboxing, one of the things we found very interesting with the book, you know, because we had to cover so much ground and we wanted to make it cohesive. When you look at what's going on with beatboxing, there's a really strong link with linguistics.
Absolutely.
Looking at how consonants are produced, some of the sounds are also ingressive, aren't they, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Sort of, in other words, done on an inhalation. All those noises your mother told you not to make, the farting, the burping noises, the noises, they're all in there.
I mean, the symbolism that's involved in this is, as it were, turning yourself into something inorganic. Yes. The voice is the greatest proof of our kind of living, organic proximity and presence. But if you're turning yourself, in the most literal sense, turning your voice into a musical instrument, but a percussion instrument for the most part, these are the things that are imitated. It's as though somehow something else, some other agency has got into your voice. It's a kind of ventriloquism, a topic on which I misspent many years of my earlier life. And the history of ventriloquism is rather interesting. Ventriloquism with dummies is a very, very late, rather exotic development. During the early 19th century, there was somebody called William Edward Love who styled himself a polyphonist. He was really a sort of imitator of sounds, largely animals, but sometimes inorganic sounds as well. And there's just something very weird about the idea that something else has got in you. You know, we have expressions like a frog in your throat, and early ventriloquists were sometimes thought to be possessed by demons because of these strange voices that seem to be coming from them, not in their control. So here, once again, we have a control and also a surrender, as though somehow something is happening in you, which is mechanical, that belongs to a sort of a machinery rather than a body. And yet, of course, you're doing it. Hence the strange, and for me, I think, the kind of splendour, the miraculous nature of this performance.
Well, perhaps one of the things there which jumps out from that, talking about this sort of idea of mechanicalness almost, is how strange it can be when we hear a machine voice. So perhaps we can talk about that. Why does that sometimes seem a little unsettling? Jeremy?
With so many machines nowadays, machine voices, robot voices, we're getting such accurate versions of consonant and vowel. Partly it's prosody, partly it's the melody that comes out. It's actually because melody in the human voice is so instinctive normally, and it's also so varied, that one of the ways that we, if I was to take the melody out completely from my voice, then there's sort of a monotone thing going on, and I don't know how much of this would be that interesting because there's nothing that's elongated or shaped. So you end up getting something that you actually stop listening to. Melody is very unusual in the human experience, and I think it's one of the messages that comes across so easily, is that all I had to do was to say so easily, and that suddenly we know that that word is more important. So I think robotic melody is part of the problem.
Jeremy and Julianne, you're both professional voice coaches, and as we've mentioned before there, you work with actors and singers and broadcasters to use their voices to the fullest potential. So what are some of the techniques that you deploy, and can you try them on me?
Well, we think it'd be useful to work on your airflow, because airflow obviously powers everything to do with the sound, and we notice your airflow is a little bit low, and that means that your speech is going to be a bit rushed, and possibly that you lose a little bit of the warmth that you could have in your voice. So where should we start, Jeremy? Do we want to do anything with the kind of the belly breathing, or are we going to just have a visual aid by working with the hand?
I think the visual aid will be very useful. If you put your hand just in front of your mouth, and obviously that's going to possibly affect the microphone use, but we'll go there.
Okay.
Put your hand in front of your mouth and just breathe out going... And you can feel warm air on your palm.
Yes.
Great. Okay, now do... Can you still feel the same amount of air on your palm?
No, I can't.
Right, your vocal folds are now interrupting the airflow, so you are using your air more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go a little breathier. So I want you to say ah, but I want you to try and make the airflow on your hand the same.
It would help her if she put an H in front.
Okay.
So you do ha.
Okay. Ha.
Good. Make your sound a little looser, a little breathier, so that you can still feel the air on your hand.
Ha.
That's very nice.
Now try this sound. Hey.
Hey.
What's interesting about what you feel on your hand is if you're still feeling more warm air, it means that your vocal folds are leaking air very slightly. Mm. What that does to your voice is it makes it slightly warmer, slightly rounder, slightly more intimate. So if I did it on my voice, it's going to sound like this. I'm leaking quite a lot of air in this, but it's very useful for close microphone work.
Let's talk a bit about the exhibition. What can people expect who come along to the Wellcome Collection?
The first thing you walk into, which is one of my favourite things, is an anechoic corridor. And that's basically got little egg box things on the wall that soak up all the sound. So the first thing you walk into is a much more muffled sound space. And it makes you realise how much ambient noise there is around the place. So that's the first thing you come to. And then you're walking around and you have... This is very much a sound-based exhibition. Television screens with all sorts of film on. You have little speakers that you can hold to your head. You have one of my favourite things, which is a sound shower. And it's a perspex dome that you can stand underneath and the sound is projected down onto you so that people who are standing outside the sound shower can't necessarily hear. And all of these techniques are designed to separate the different exhibits. So it's very much an experiential thing.
Very much on the wild side is the Marcus Coates birdsong experiment.
Yes.
Where he recorded birdsong and what they did was they slowed it down.
12 times.
And then they asked a group of individuals to imitate the birds. And so they did it at the slowed down speed, was also the slowed down pitch.
They could do it at human pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've speeded it up. And it is extraordinary because you see these people moving like a bird with these kind of little sort of fluttering movements and producing birdsong. It's absolutely astonishing.
One of the other things, though, is that people can actually donate their voice.
Very much.
So can you tell me a bit about that?
And I did. There is a booth. It's the last thing that you do before you leave the exhibition. There's a sound booth there that you can go into, press a button, and hold a note as long as you can. And that note gets added to a series of notes produced by hundreds of people. You become part of the exhibition. And what I loved is I only read last week that, in fact, the sound is piped through to the Royal Opera House stage door. So my voice is on there. I really recommend that you go and do that.
That exhibition is on until July the 31st. And the accompanying book, This Is a Voice, by Julianne and Jeremy, is published now by the Wellcome Collection. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Jeremy Fisher, Julianne Kayes and Stephen Connor. For me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.